this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Dr. Athol Sutherland Brown, recorded on March 10th, 2015 at 546 Newport Avenue by Mackenzie Carr. So, Dr. Athol Sutherland Brown, do I have your permission to record this interview? Do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yeah.
All right. So, can I ask you to state your name?
Athol Sutherland Brown.
All right, thank you. So, I would just like to start off with some interview startup questions.
Yep.
So, where were you born?
I was born in Ottawa in 1923.
And did you grow up in Ottawa?
No, I was there till I was about 5, and then I was in London, England for a year, and then my family moved to Victoria. And I've lived most of my life in Victoria, except during the war and university years and some years in professionally as a geologist.
Awesome. And did you, I saw your biography, you wrote about your father?
Mm-hmm.
And his time as a bugler to a brigadier general? Was that part of you moving around as a child?
Yes, that's why we were in London, England. He was at the Imperial Defence College then, and then he was made general in charge of the military district in Victoria, which existed at that time. And if you read the book, you'd see he had difficulties with his boss, General McNaughton. And he resigned from the army in 1933.
You said you spent most of your time here, except your post-secondary education. Obviously, you got your PhD. Where did you go to school for that?
Well, I went got a bachelor in applied science at UBC and a PhD at Princeton University.
And you currently live here in Victoria. Do you have any children?
Well, I have one son who's lives in California at the present time.
Oh, awesome. And you currently live here with...
Beg your pardon?
Who do you live here currently with? Just your wife?
Yes, my wife lives here, yeah.
All right.
And she is my second wife. My first wife died... about 18 years ago.
Sorry to hear that. All right. So, your just another question. Your family history, other than your father, did you have any other family members in the war?
First World War, you mean, or the second?
Both.
Well, yes, I had two uncles in the First World War, at least, and a whole bunch of other connections. In the Second World War, I had my brother Malcolm, who was my eldest brother, who was a combat engineer and landed in D-Day, and went all through the war. He was over there in 1940 and through the war, and ended up fighting in the polders in the Low Country. So he was there the whole time. My other brother, Ian, was killed in an air accident. He was in the Air Force as an instructor at Calgary, and he was killed in an air accident in 1941.
So you're having two brothers in the war. What did your family think when you joined the Air Force?
Well, they expected me to join up in some sort of service. They expected me to join the Air Force because I had a desire to fly.
When you joined at 18 in Vancouver, you stated?
Yes, was a long process, and I started in Victoria, but I actually joined up in Vancouver in August 1941, when I was 18 years old.
So, what was your training like after your enlistment, before you went over to Southeast Asia?
I qualified for pilot training, and I did elementary flying training at Boundary Bay. We were the first class there in January 42, I guess it was, and then advanced flying at in Calgary at Curry Field, as existed then. And then I did a, what's called a GR course, which is basically navigation for pilots who were expected to go into Coastal Command, and this was in Prince Edward Island. Then I went overseas and had a refresher course there, and then went to operational training units, one near Edinburgh and one near Hull just near Hull in Yorkshire.
Wow.
And then, well, I don't know if you got another question, or should we just lead on for what I did from there? I was just going to say, after OTU, I flew an aircraft out there from the factory at Filton, which is in Bristol, out to India, a bow fighter, and that was really a reinforcement flight. And that's quite a test, of course, for a 20-year-old. Or, yes, I guess I was 20 then. Just 20, yeah. And then I, after a short time in a pool, which was characteristic, spent some time waiting for various postings. And then I was with a communication squadron and working out of Delhi for about 5 months, I think. Eventually got to 177th Squadron on the Burma frontier, flying bow fighters. Was I well trained? Yes. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Well, yeah, the training was excellent and extensive. By the time I had finished OTU, Operational Training Unit, I had about 360 flying hours, and all the training was first class, and you know, if you wanted to be critical, there were some elements of it. I think considering we were on training on ground attack, we didn't have enough gunnery practice, but otherwise it was excellent.
So you said you flew the Bristol Bow Fighter. You said in your book, actually, the Japanese called it the Whispering Death.
Whispering Death, yeah. That was what they called the Australian ones. It was used generally. Australia had bow fighters too, flying in the Pacific War. And bow fighters were used in a number of ventures. They were the first significant night fighter, and they were used in strike squadrons against convoys on the Norway coast and in the deserts and in Burma frontier. Most of the operations were low-level attacks. They were not designed for high-level operations. They weren't obviously as maneuverable as single-engine fighters, but they were a very rugged, well-powered, long-range fighter aircraft.
As a pilot, were they easy to fly or hard to?
Well, no, not exactly. They had two very powerful engines, which were actually ahead of the nose of the aircraft, as you could see on this cover painting. The engines actually stick out beyond the, and they're 1,600 horsepower each with big propellers. So there was a tremendous torque when you opened up the throttles, and you had to compensate that. So they were not easy for a beginner to fly, but they were very effective in the air. And they also had a characteristic, there's no autopilot, and you had to fly them hands-on all the time. You were continuously trimming. So they weren't easy, but they were good.
What tactics did you use?
Well, we were, our primary targets were trains and locomotives and river boats. Well, we sunk all the whole Burma flotilla, so the Japanese couldn't use the river boats. And then we attacked motor transport. And the most difficult targets, of course, were airfields attacking Japanese airfields. All ground attack. Well, virtually all. We did some intruder operations also.
Why was your main targets trains, locomotives, ships, and transport?
Yes, what's the question? Oh,
why were they most important?
Well, we were
target
trying to, well, we're very effective interdicting the flow of supplies and troops to the Japanese armies at the front, because we operated long distance behind the front. By damaging the railway system, it was very difficult for them to resupply. And it's strategic, really, rather than tactical, but it had a tremendous effect on the course of the war.
So, you were part of Squadron 177?
Yeah.
What was your crew like?
Well, the crew, you had a navigator. Well, he was called an observer because he was more than a navigator. He was a navigator, radio operator, and gunner, all combined in one role. And he sat in a dorsal position. Dorsal, if you understand what that means. He's in a little bubble well behind the pilot who's up in the front. And he was very good at all the things he did. Very quiet and competent young Englishman.
So it was only you and him?
Yes.
Did you and your observer stay together during your entire time in flight?
Yes, we crewed up, as it's called, at our OTU in Yorkshire, and we were together until I left the squadron in the end of January 1945. So that was from August 43 to 45. That's a long time. And during an operational tour and a tour with a, I'm flying a boat fighter out to India and also flying on the communication squadron. That's unusual in a way to have someone do the equivalent of two tours together.
Why is that? Can you expand on that?
Well, for a number of reasons. Often after a tour, the people get dispersed to different jobs, and they probably don't come back together after that.
Did you like that you got to stay
with... He and I got along well together. He was a very good navigator. And mind you, most of the crews were good on our squadron. So, but you like to fly with someone you knew and could trust.
For sure. Now, you stated in your book, Silently Into the Midst of Things, that that was your motto.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that? Why was that a motto for you?
Well, the bullfighter was very quiet on approach. So that's what the silently means, and that's why they're called Whispering Death by the Japanese. It had very heavy armament, 4 20-millimeter cannons. And the original versions had 8 machine guns also firing forward, but they were taken out for us in the Far East to increase our range, and so we could fly from the border of India all the way to halfway down through what was then called Siam or Thailand, up to 7 hours, long time in the air.
Was 7 hours your longest time in the air?
Yes, that's very long for a fighter.
Oh, for sure. So when you were in Southeast Asia, what was it like interacting with the different cultures and the different ethnicities when you were on the ground?
When you're on a frontline squadron on the Burma frontier, we didn't have much contact. There were some people on the squadron who did, who had to buy food and that sort of thing, but we had almost no contact then, except it sounds sort of foolish, but we all had personal servants, which were called bearers, and I had a Goanese Christian, very good servant. But apart from him, the only time you had interaction was when you were traveling on leave or... And of course, India in those days was curious in the sense that they were, the government was an Indian government, but Gandhi and his fellows were all in jail, so there was a fair amount of resentment against the British, an anti-colonial movement, you could call it. And India was also starting to be torn apart with the growth of what ended up as Pakistan. So it didn't affect us much, but there were the odd, there was one Canadian pilot just traveling by train, and he had a stop insurgents jumped in and shot him in the carriage, and he was just traveling from point A to point B. So, but the resentment against the Brits, that they couldn't distinguish between Canadians and British. We wore virtually the same uniform, only different being Canada on the shoulder. So I guess in some places it was difficult, but as I say, on the squadron, we were unaffected by that. We were in a fairly remote locations right on the Burma frontier. Our two airfields we flew from.
Now, from what I've read in your book especially, you were affected by weather and the monsoons quite often. As a pilot, what was that like on either the maintenance of the plane or just daily flying?
Well, there are two monsoons, one where the air froze out of the Central Asia, back south, and that's the dry monsoon, and it happens in the winter, the so-called winter, and then the wet monsoon, the southeast monsoon, comes about in the middle of May and lasts through to September. The month before it is full of storm clouds, individual, just tremendous cumulonimbus clouds, which are very dangerous to fly through. And we probably lost some aircraft in flying through these clouds and in the monsoon. And the ground crew, of course, had no hangars. We were on temporary airfields, and there were no hangars for them, so they worked in the blinding sun sometimes, and then tremendous downpours. So it was, that made maintenance difficult in a number of ways, not least because extensive filtering had to be done to try and keep water out of the gasoline. But during the worst of the monsoon, some of our flights were affected. You took off and the engines weren't performing properly because there was just a small amount of water in the gasoline. But the worst part of it was, of course, storm clouds. And on several operations, I flew into the cloud at 500 feet off the airfield, and I was in cloud all the way to the target area. Sometimes very turbulent in the cumulonimbus clouds. So yeah, the monsoon was very difficult, and our standard procedures, we flew during the moon period, the 2 weeks of which the moon was effective, and even during the monsoon, we attempted to fly at night in this terrible weather. So, yes, it was very difficult to fly. And the Japanese basically withdrew their aircraft from the Burma front into Thailand during the monsoon.
Other than the monsoons, the heat, or did that have any effect?
The diet?
The heat.
Heat. Well, it was unpleasant. At its worst, it was in Bengal, the Burma frontier. The temperature was around 90 and the humidity 100%, so it was difficult. The winter period was relatively pleasant.
So you said that when you flew in the monsoons, even you mainly flew at night, is that correct?
Yeah, we flew, was in a one of our flights was sent up to a place called Imphal, very critical in the war in Southeast Asia. In a little valley in the Chin Hills, mountains up to 10,000 feet, and with cloud all around, and we flew out of there at night attacking trains and ships and motor transport. Very difficult period, very difficult.
Tropical diseases were also pretty common for men who were European men and Canadians in Southeast Asia. Did that ever affect you or your comrades?
Tropical diseases you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yes, they affected us all the time. We suffered regularly from intestinal diseases, some of them not very serious, but objectionable. Of course, dysentery was a factor. And cleanliness in the kitchens was a critical problem for that. And then, of course, mosquitoes were a problem. We used mosquito nets. And we took a pill called Mepocrin, which actually reduced the chances of malaria to almost nothing. But it didn't. Dengue fever, you could get from little flies that could go through mosquito netting. So there were a lot of hazards, as we used to say. Tropical diseases were the second enemy.
So, starting with your first operation, was your first operation in Burma, or where was it?
Well, basically it was considered operations flying a plane out to India, because we flew through enemy-held territory part of the way. But basically, yes, Burma frontier. The very first operation I went on, we flew down the Irrawaddy past the petroleum-producing area where I was a wingman, and my leader was hit by frack artillery, and he had to peel off back home, and he was moderately heavily wounded, but he flew it back to base, and I accompanied him back. So yeah, that was my first operation in Burma.
What was your most difficult in-flight operation you participated in?
It's hard for me to say which was the most difficult. I had almost every operation. We came back with some bullet holes in us. The Japanese, the individual soldiers were trained not to run for cover, but to shoot at you. So that was a slight hazard, but of course, attacking railways with every station had major frack installations, and we got hit moderately severely quite often. But which were the most dangerous? Well, probably the time I was doing an operation around Maitila airfield, not attacking the airfield as such, but around the periphery of it, attacking gas trucks and trucks and stuff. And at the south end of this, there were about seven airfields there. And I was flying south down the railway after, I said to my navigator, I'll turn on to 270, that's west, to give me a correction for a base, and he said, skipper probably should go farther south. But by then I had already turned, and the next thing I saw, we were going over revetments. That's earthen housings for aircraft. And at the same time, we were under severe flak attack, and we were hit about, we took about 50 shots through the aircraft, some of them explosive bullets. And I lost my hydraulics, we lost our radio, neither of us were wounded, but it was, I could see the oil coming out of the engine, port engine, and I thought it was engine oil, but it was the hydraulic fluid. So when I got back to base, I have to crash land, of course, wheels up landing, without flaps. So that was a difficult operation, but I had other ones that were almost as bad. We attacked a small convoy down south of Moulmein, a little island there where it was sheltering. There were about seven ships there, many of them were flak on it, and that was a difficult operation. And then my last operation, 49th, we flew 50 operations, which was more than almost anyone else, because fighter aircraft were, 50 was quite common, but some of our trips were, they were all 4 hours long. Many of them were six and a half. So a large number of hours on operations. And my 49th operation, I was wounded attacking a train near Pegu, just close to Rangoon, and bleeding quite badly, but I managed, it wasn't bad enough. There were flesh wounds. So I flew back. So there's three operations that were, that's considered, I think you consider quite hazardous.
Definitely. So the as hazardous close call kind of in-flight operations, how would you rate the Japanese aircraft and the pilots during your time in Southeast Asia?
Well, the Japanese fighters that were the Army 01 or Oscar, actually it was, that was a code name for it. It was about, looked almost the same as a Zero. And it was very, it had long range and was fast and very maneuverable. We were just about as fast, so it wasn't the main hazard for us. Our main hazard was ground flak when we were attacking significant targets like airfields or railways. Although we did have several aircraft shot down by Japanese fighters, this, as I say, it wasn't our main hazard. And but the Japanese, you may know, I interviewed seven Japanese pilots in the year 2000. And it was published in an article in the Canadian Military History called Burma Banzai, the Air War Through Japanese Eyes. And these were all well-trained pilots, and they were survivors. But Japanese suffered tremendous casualties, and so their later pilots were not as well trained, and as I say, weren't a great hazard to us. But I worked around the periphery of it, and attacking trains within about 10 miles of Rangoon, and also down to Moulmein. And we attacked airfields like Maitila, one of the biggest airfields the Japanese occupied in central Burma. So our job wasn't to attack towns, mm-hmm. You know, it was to attack the transportation systems. And there wasn't any advantage in going into a city, although we went, of course, all the railways had little towns and villages along them, and that's where the chief anti-aircraft flak we met was located.
Did you know you were attacking, like when you were told to attack these targets, did you know what you were attacking essentially?
Oh, yeah. Yes, well, I mean, I trained in because of our attacks, the Japanese trains moved only at night. And so that's one reason our attacks during the moon period were so important, because we could catch them between stations where they didn't have any flak protection, or only a few of them had flak on them, like the German trains regularly did. The Japanese motor transport convoys traveled at night too, because of the hazard from our attacks. But in the daylight, if they were moving by daylight, of course, in most of the year, they stirred up tremendous dust so you could see them miles away, which made them an easy target. And you knew if you were attacking an airfield, which we did on a number of occasions, that was our most difficult target because of heavy flak. And you basically just had time for one attack as you drove through across it, and very hazardous.
So, do you have any other memorable or interesting stories that stick out in your mind from your time as a pilot?
Well, life on the squadron was very collegial. We were, as a truism is, we were a band of brothers. So, we got along well together. That was one aspect that made life fairly pleasant. The other, we were all young, about your age. What age are you?
I'm 21.
Well, you see, I was finished my operations when I was 21, or just about. So young people are not adverse to risk, and we love flying, almost all of us. So there are a few who didn't, navigators in particular. And our flying was the very most exciting kind, because we were flying at 50 feet below the radar. So every flight was exciting, just the flying part of it was.
Was radar...
Japanese radar wasn't half as good as German radar, but we tried to avoid it at all times, which meant low flying, and as our targets were along the ground. But of course, once you got on a railway and headed down looking for aircraft, most of them in the daytime would be in, they had protective shelters for them, made it very difficult to attack, and in these would be in the little towns, and they were defended by Bofors type 40 millimeter guns and also 50 caliber machine guns, which made, when they were in their locomotive shelters, these were along, meant you could only attack along the line of the railway, which so made you an obvious target that way.
What other technology did you find was crucial or reliable during your flights, like radio or anything?
Well, we had VHF radio for, let's call it airfield, although we maintained radio silence during our operations, unlike the Americans.
How come?
Well, the Americans had a reputation for talking on radio all the time. We didn't, because that gave your position away to some degree. But we also were able to send Morse code messages by using a trailing antenna, even when we were hundreds and hundreds of miles away from base. And VHF radio was like radar, basically. It was affected by the curvature of the Earth, so if you were, the Earth is like this, and if you're down here, it can't reach base. But Morse code can, because and telegraphic goes up and down, so I don't think you need to know the technology, but in those days there was no satellites, so there's no capability of sending signals by very high frequency radio from 400 miles away, which we would sometimes be. And we didn't have any, basically very little homing. There was a system of, in heavy weather, of homing on your airfield, which was quite effective, but we didn't have any complicated systems.
So you spoke earlier about your morale during war, of your band of brothers and your love of flying, and you stated that the navigators didn't exactly like flying. Why?
Well, it was a very difficult job. The navigator had no control over what you were doing, and you were diving at targets, and he's looking backwards, and you know, very stressful for the navigators. And they, my navigator, and most of them, would ask, you dive down on your target and you pull up, so you're not an easy target yourself, and you cut to one side or the other, and he would start firing with his little machine gun backwards, so tending to keep the Japanese heads down, you might say, to increase your chance of escape from it. So it was a very difficult job for them, and most of them liked flying too, but it was a very stressful, because at least as a pilot you had control of the plane.
For sure. When you said you, when did you leave Southeast Asia? When did you end your term?
Well, my last flight was on the 28th of December, 1944, and I was wounded on that. I spent a couple of weeks in hospital, and I got out, and there was a flap on, so I got no leave after coming out of the hospital. I was posted directly to a small unit which was concerned with direct air support control at the front. And I had four jeeps and seven men, and we drove the jeeps all the way to Manawa in central Burma, where the front was. And I no sooner got there, and I was posted back to Canada almost right away, so I didn't have much experience with the ground war, thank goodness.
So, your reaction when you did go home, what was your reaction like, knowing you'd be going home even before the war?
Well, it was a pleasure to... India was a beautiful but dirty country. Interesting, very interesting, but, you know, getting back to Great Britain, was interesting, and then I was posted right back to Canada and got back between VE Day and VJ Day, so in the middle of the summer. And as VE Day came, they were looking to get rid of people out of the services already, so I was demobbed back at university in September 45.
Wow. So at the end of all of that, and even to present day, how did war change you, being so young? And
now, what's the question again?
How did war change you?
Well, I was 18 years old when I joined up, not very experienced youth, and by the time I got out of the Air Force, I'd flown around the world, and I had seen all sorts of conditions of man, and one of the things that, just to look at the negative thing, I was in India during a famine there, and at Hura Station in Calcutta, you were stepping over bodies and you didn't know whether they were alive or dead. Terrible sort of thing. So my experience had broadened. I'd seen good and bad all over the world, developed into a young man of considerable experience. And I've said this to others, one of the strange things, that the only sort of really negative thing that seemed to affect me was that, having lived day to day for well over a year, I found in the early post-war period very difficult to plan ahead. You live day to day for that long, that's the way you tended to go on.
So has your perception of your time in the Second World War changed over your time, including all your research with the many articles and books you've written?
Well, I don't think so. I think, and of course, I was a geologist and a working geologist, and so really it wasn't until I retired from geology I started rethinking and rewriting my experiences and other things related to the war. That's quite a common thing. As a professional geologist, that was my main concern. I was writing and thinking and exploring and stuff on, and I didn't. Spare time was taken up with family and perhaps sports. So it wasn't until you had a little more time that you started thinking about the war and your personal experiences.
So one of my last questions, do you think aviation was the main cause of the success for the Allied powers in Southeast Asia?
Can you say that again?
Yeah. Do you think aviation was the main cause of success for the Allied powers in Southeast Asia?
Which was the main cause?
Aviation. Aviation?
Oh, well, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't.
No, that's okay.
Well, it certainly was. It wasn't appreciated by a lot of people, historians and others, because the 14th Army depended entirely on air supply, especially when it was working through the muddy, bloody Chin Hills. And General Slim said this himself, their operations were impossible unless you had complete control of the air. In addition, he appreciated the air supply, and they whole divisions were moved to the front with much of their equipment by air. First time that had ever been done. So yeah, the air war in Burma was terribly important. General Slim appreciated also the, let's call it, the support he had from ground attack fighters right at where the operations were. He didn't understand that squadron, the low fighter squadrons and some bombing squadrons were interdicting just and preventing the Japanese from bringing up supplies. The Japanese were short of supplies and ammunition and men all during the war, at least not all during the war, during the campaigns in 44. And so it's hard to imagine the victory in Burma being done so easily and so quickly without this tremendous air component. And it wasn't just the bow fighters. The arrival of Spitfires out there in mid-43, they were the ones who basically got control of the air and maintained it. We were the ones who basically cut off supplies to the Japanese front. So we had control of the air, and we had a tremendous number of transport squadrons, DC-3s, Dakotas, and during periods in the Chin Hill, the whole large units were supplied entirely by parachute, including ammunition and everything. So yes, the air war was a critical factor in success in Burma, freeing of Burma. The Burmese, as you probably know, they were anti-colonial too, and were more or less welcomed the Japanese when they arrived there in the defeat in Burma in 42. But it didn't take them long to see that that their friends were worse than the British, and so they set up an army which was designed to counter the colonial Brits, which turned around and started fighting the Japanese. Well, that's a whole different story. So,
You've also written your article Forgotten Squared and Victory in Burma, as well as your book Silently Into the Mitts. You've acknowledged numerous times how Canadians aren't very much mentioned as their participation.
Right. Yeah, at the end of the Burma campaign, about 30% of the air crew in Burma were Canadians, and no, they're not recognized for what they did there.
Why do you think that is?
Well, maybe sloth. Media willing to dig up the information and write about it. There's a certain amount, but it wasn't recognized what a big impact Canadians had in the Far East War. Aircrew, mind you. We had almost no army out there, except we had a lot of radar operators who had very difficult jobs too. Forward radar stations were largely manned by Canadians. So we had a, and you know, it was a Commonwealth effort. And on our squadron we had About 30% of the squadron was either Canadian or Australian. Not the squadron, of the air crew, of the pilots. Even the navigators were mostly British. But as I say, there were the odd New Zealanders, but there were a lot of Australians and Canadians on our squadron. And on the Liberator squadrons, the air crew were almost entirely Canadian. And that was the heavy bomber squadrons out there. And the reason for that is that the Liberator OTUs were in Canada, so they had Canadian crews.
Sure. And lastly, my question is, you received the DFC in 1945?
Yes.
And the wound stripe?
Yes.
You received those. What did it mean for you to receive the DFC?
Well, yes, I'm very proud of the DFC, and basically I think I got it because I'm very successful at, I was a good shot as well as a pretty good pilot, and I was involved in attacking something like 20 to 22 locomotives and trains, as well as other targets. So it was a recognition of the success I'd had as a ground attack pilot.
Awesome. Well, I'm completed all my questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No. If you've read my articles, which you seem to have, and I've given you a little aid to my memoir. I'll just show you my logbook. It's a bit of a mess, but you can see each flight is recorded.
Oh, wow.
And then there's evaluations. For instance, well, that's not the best one. The final evaluation here. Yeah, so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you can see.
Who evaluates you?
Well, your squadron commander.
Oh, who was your squadron commander?
Well, there, I had three while I was there. One of them was shot down, but he wasn't killed. And he actually had a remarkable, well, it's in the book, so you could read it there.
Definitely.
And they were all good guys. But you can see, here's a, I'll have to put my specs on to. Well, here's November the 14th, Bowfighter X-A, that was my favorite aircraft, and my navigator was W.O. Aldham. See, you fill this all the way out, and it said Ops, shipping recce, Gulf of Martaban, Caligoc Island, on return attacked Creek steamer, something, ammunition finished. So, you know, that's just one day. I don't know what this is. This is, someone went to the War Museum in London who read my book, and he sent this to me. This is from the logbook of one of my COs, John Hill, and so it's a logbook like this, and he's written it in red script, And so you can see it's the same format as this.
Yes.
And here in detail it says, Ops, Railway, Mandalay, Delasio, shot up three lorries, two MTs, something else. Anyway, I can't read it, something, to, anyway, number two, Flight Lieutenant Sutherland Brown.
Oh, wow.
So he just sent that to me. This is, I did this for the Canadian War Museum. I put this together. It's shorthand of all my operations with, and it, it's all the targets, so 6 motor transport shared. I was flying with someone else that day, flak damage, 2 steamrollers, railroad trucks, these are the damage, 2 locos shared buildings, photo recce, 1 MT, 1 loco and truck shared, 2 locos and trucks shared, says 6 locos, that's a lot, 2 MTs, railroad trucks, attacked lights, that must have been a night flight, aborted, cannons unserviceable. So if your cannons couldn't fire, there's no use going there. So the aborted loco, you're still credited, aborted operation, you're still credited with it, unless you do too many, and then you're figured out you're not doing your job. So it goes on down the whole array of things. So, as I say, we all had logbooks, and they record everything you, including the number of different aircraft you've flown. Oh, here's a great friend of mine who was a just see him here to show you it's not. I went to school in Victoria with him, Ian Gillespie. And he was shot down on the coast of Norway. And we were at OTU together too. So it wasn't a game.
No.
Okay.
Yes, well, this concludes the Military Oral History Program with program interview with Dr. Sutherland Brown on March 10th, 2015. If I could just get you to fill this out. You have a pen. Perfect.
MAC?
Yes.
And a capital K?
Yep.
Car, C-A-R-R?
Yep.
And how did they call you Mackenzie?
My parents have a Scottish background, so.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so.
But it still tends to be a surname or perhaps a name for a boy.
Yeah, I don't know. They just liked it for a girl, I guess.
Okay.
Wanted to be different.
University of Victoria on the following dates. Well, the date is the 10th of... Okay. Understood and agreed to me that no information obtained by this interview is currently classified under any government security class. Well, that's true. I understand that any and all transcripts, notes, radio, audio and visual tapes, digital or other records, including CD-ROM version, resulting from this oral history interview will belong to UVic to be used in any manner deemed the best interest of the university. I hereby volunteer relinquish copyright de-dum-de-dum and all rights distributed.
So just sign that first line and date there. Awesome. And yeah, I could just get you to sign that as well.
Releaser, signature, that's my signature that you want there?
Yeah, just that, and then just print your name. And just, oh, that's your copy?
Oh, my copy.
Yeah, can I just confirm we both signed these on record?
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.